Thank you. This talk should have probably been on Thursday, but I'm leaving tomorrow and the organizers were kind enough to move me. So I'll just start off by pointing out my collaborators in this. Jim Stone and Norm Murray, I think, are in the audience. Norm's blocking himself. And then Yan Fei Jiang, he's a postdoc at the CFA. So this is going to be a talk on predominantly on numerical simulations. And the numerical simulations I'm going to show were done using our Athena code. We implemented, Yan Fei and Jim and I, we implemented a radiation hydro scheme. And I'll describe that briefly before I get to the topic of interest. OK, so we've had a lot of introduction the last 2 days. I'm sure these talks that we've had are a much better introduction than I could give to this topic. But you know, basically what I'm interested with this problem is how turbulence and outflows are driven in star-forming galaxies, sort of very broadly. You know, if we actually look at molecular lines in these galaxies, they show velocity dispersions of hundreds of kilometers per second, but the thermal velocities in molecular gas are less than a kilometer per second, so we have this high Mach number turbulence to explain. We heard a lot of talk about outflows already. This is M82 showing ionized gas. I'm particularly interested, I think, mostly in how you drive neutral and molecular gas from these galaxies. And I'll just tell you the answer for the sake of this talk. What drives these things is we're going to consider the possibility that radiation pressure from ultraviolet and actually specifically infrared on opacity on dust grains of dust grains is actually what's providing the feedback here. Now, of course, there's plenty of other things that might be important, and you know, they're certainly worth considering. But for this problem, I just want to do as simple of a sort of basic physics problem as possible. So I'm going to ignore anything else that might be going on. As we heard yesterday, that might be problematic. I'm not trying to explain all these observational properties of galaxies, but I still think that excluding even sort of secondary sources of turbulence might actually qualitatively affect these simulation results. So it's something to keep in mind. Okay. Again, I'm particularly interested in applications to ultraluminous infrared galaxies. That's because the surface densities are so high in these things that many, at least some EULERGs, are optically thick to their own infrared emission. Maybe most. I think that's an important question. Maybe we'll address at the end of the talk or after the talk. ARP220 is sort of the source I have in mind when I think about EULERGs. I know it's sort of one of the denser, more extreme cases. But if you actually look and try to model the SED, which is dust emission, and you look at the molecular gas, you come to the conclusion that this thing is very optically thick. The surface density is quite high. There's this paper by Rangwala et al. In 2011. They suggest by fitting the Herschel spectra that optical depth at 100 microns is as high as 5. If you try to translate that into a mean opacity or Rosalind mean opacity, optical depth could easily be 10 in this source. Okay, that's probably somewhat uncertain. All right, so we've already seen this radiation feedback equation several times in this conference. I just want to sort of review it one more time. So the idea is that if you want to estimate the radiation feedback that's going on in these galaxies, you need to calculate the time rate of change of momentum, which is just the force, which is just proportional to the luminosity divided by the speed of light. If you only get one absorption, you get a factor of one here. That's what you get in ultraviolet. You absorb your UV photon and turn it re-emit it in the infrared. In the case of dust, because you have multiple scatterings or emissions and reabsorptions, you can in principle get a factor of tau larger force from the from this effect. So as we've already heard, there's been lots of numerical simulations that incorporate this sort of feedback effect. We've had talks by Hopkins, Eggerts, Karas yesterday. And you know, basically, my takeaway from their talk and reading their papers is that if you want to reproduce you know, galaxy properties, particularly at sort of the low mass end, and you want to, you know, reproduce observables like velocities and mass loss rates and other properties, you need to have radiation feedback. And it's important to have, I think, my impression is it's important to have this enhancement in the infrared for at least certain applications. And so, you know, this is the sort of prescription they're using. Now, you know, for example, in Phil's paper, he includes a little efficiency factor in there because he was worried about things like inhomogeneities. And they do some estimates, and they suggest that maybe this factor is around unity, a little bit lower, depending on the model they assume. But then there was this very interesting work by Mark Krumholtz and Todd Thompson in 2012 and 2013. And basically what they argued is on the basis of radiation hydro simulations that the Rayleigh-Taylor instability is important in these systems, and that's probably going to inhibit radiation feedback and reduce this trapping factor. Now, I was actually very disappointed because when I started doing this radiation hydro code, this was exactly one of the problems I had in mind to do, so I was annoyed that they beat me to it. But that's life. So what they found, what they argued is that for momentum injection, you're probably usually limited to something like L over C. There might be a little bit of a trapping factor, but it's probably not very large. And they argued this on the basis of more or less 2 points. One is that because of the Rayleigh-Taylor instability, effective efficiency of coupling of momentum of radiation gases is low. And they also argue in their 2013 paper that in general, at least for ULURGs, the optical depths tend to be around unity or less in most systems. And that's maybe something we can touch on later. So basically, the focus of this talk is going to be whether I can reproduce or we can reproduce these simulations with our Athena radiation hydro code. So I just want to review radiation transfer real quickly. I think some people are not experts on the topic. If you want to numerically solve radiation transfer, you want to start with the radiation transfer equation. Here I've just written down the Gray approximation, so we've integrated over frequency. When you have just sort of continuum opacities, this seems like a sensible thing to do. You replace your frequency-dependent opacities by mean opacities, and that takes care of one dimension. You still have a five-dimensional phase space for the intensity, three spatial dimensions, and two angles, typically a azimuthal and ploidal angle. N-hat here is just a unit vector that specifies your direction on the unit sphere. And then you have these sort of complicated expressions. You have terms for scattering. You have, because we're solving this in a actual simulation where things are moving around, we have all these velocity-dependent terms. This J and H here are angular integrals over the radiation intensity. So this couples angles, different angles together. So this makes this an integral differential equation. It's very hard to solve. So usually we want to simplify things. The simplest way to simplify this is to integrate over angle. You just angle average this. You get an equation that corresponds to the radiation energy conservation, evolution equation for the energy density. And if you multiply by a factor of n hat and take the integral, you get an evolution equation for a vector, which corresponds to the radiation flux. And this represents conservation of momentum for the radiation field. OK. So the problem here is we have to deal with this radiation pressure. And unlike hydrodynamics, we don't have a good equation of state that we can specify in advance. And in practice, what we do is we first do a simple definition. We replace radiation pressure by the Eddington tensor times an energy density. This doesn't solve anything. It's just a definition. But this only encapsulates the angular distribution of the radiation field, so it's easier to work with. Then we have to couple it to hydro. So here's the hydro equations in white. Here's that radiation subsystem in yellow. I've just renamed these source terms that were on the right-hand side. Important thing to note is the negative of these comes in on the right-hand side of hydro, so total energy, total momentum are conserved. In general, this is a very hard system to solve because this evolves on the light crossing time, whereas this evolves on much shorter time scales. These are the time scales of interest in most problems. And so we have to solve this implicitly. These source terms can be quite stiff. So solving this in general is a very difficult problem. You need a good algorithm for it. And even if you have a good algorithm, you still have to deal with this Eddington tensor. Okay. So you can read our papers if you want more detail on how we solve that system. So one solution for dealing with this radiation, this Eddington tensor, is actually just to throw out the momentum equation entirely, because that's the only place where it appears. And so what you do is you just specify a form for the flux. The radiation flux is given by a diffusion approximation, where it's proportional to the gradient in the energy density divided by the opacity. And then you put this function out in front, which is called the flux limiter. And so in the optically thick limit, this limiter just goes to unity. It's just a function of the energy density and the opacity. And so it goes to unity in the optically thick limit, and you just get back the diffusion approximation, which is a good approximation when you're optically thick. But it's not a good approximation when you're optically thin. This would greatly overestimate the flux in the optically thin region. So what this function really does is it limits the flux to be no bigger than C times the radiation energy density. And it tries to do that in sort of a very reasonable way, given the simplifying assumptions that this limiter only depends on the energy density, its gradient, and the opacity. And this is nice because you get one partial differential equation instead of four, but there's no such thing as a free lunch. This has several issues. Limiter is a fairly simple function of local variables and their gradients. And the flux is always constrained to point along the gradient in the energy density. So what we tried to do, which we thought or hope is better, and I think we've done a lot of tests of this showing that it is in fact better, something we call the variable Eddington tensor method. And so we keep the momentum equation, and we solve for this Eddington tensor by solving the time-independent transfer equation on each time step. And so the time-independent transfer equation is just this. The gradient along a particular direction is just a source term minus a sink term. And we solve this using something called the short characteristics method. Basically, at each grid zone in your hydro grid, you set up an angular grid, basically just a distribution of rays, and you solve this transfer equation along those rays. And this is basically a method that's been used in the stellar atmospheres community for decades. So it's pretty well understood how to do this. This expression is a little bit simpler than the one I showed previously. And basically what you could do is you could take all these extra terms and sort of insert them into your definition of S and total opacity. But in practice for this problem, we actually just drop all the velocity-dependent terms because that's a very good approximation because V over C is so small. And here we ignore any scattering component in the dust, so it's just absorption opacity. So this is just dust absorption opacity, and this is just the thermal source function. And then just to summarize, if you're still with me, this is what we do for our algorithm. On each time step, we solve the equations of hydrodynamics using standard Athena algorithms. Then we solve the time-independent radiative of transfer equation, as I just described it, get the Eddington tensor. Then, taking this Eddington tensor, we feed that into the time-dependent solution of the radiation energy and momentum equations with all those velocity-dependent terms kept in the moment equations. And then this gives us the source terms, which we put back in and advance the hydro variables. And we just repeat this every time step. Okay, so what does this get us? Well, there's a lot of advantages. I'll just show you one very simple example problem of where this is sort of better than doing just plain old flux limit diffusion. This is just a dense cloud in the middle of an optically thin region. Okay, so the radiation field's coming in from the left and moving to the right. It's basically the radiation field is plane parallel. It's coming in parallel to the x-axis. Because you have this dense cloud in the middle, the energy density, which is the color here, is low in the cloud. All the radiation is absorbed on the front side of this cloud. Out here, the radiation density is high, and behind the cloud, the radiation density is low because, as we all know from our experience, if you have an optically thick thing in front of you, it casts a shadow. Okay? But this here represents a very large gradient in the energy density, discontinuous jump. And as I said, flux limit diffusion assumes that wherever you have a gradient in the energy density, you need a flux, and so it would tend to fill that in. If you actually just evolve the FLD equations and you watch how the radiation field sweeps across the cloud, you can see it just fills in behind the cloud. And eventually, when you're all said and done, you have almost as much radiation on the back side of the cloud as the front side of the cloud. Okay? So that's the sort of things that can go wrong. And you'll see why I was belaboring this point shortly. Okay. But to get to the actual problem we're interested in, we're actually interested in how hydrostatic equilibrium might work in a Euler disk. Okay, so this is going to be a gross approximation. I would blame, this is basically the way Mark and Todd set up the problem, and I would blame Mark since he's here, but I actually think they set it up in a very sensible way. They set it up in a way which has some simplifications, but makes it a nice simple physics problem to solve. And so you, what you do is you assume that your disk is at the midpoint of your disk. You have all your stars, all your UV emitters, and that basically all of your UV emission is downgraded to the infrared very near to those stars, and then you simulate the region above that. Okay, so you assume all your incoming radiation at the base of your domain is already infrared radiation. You assume there's no more sources of radiation in your atmosphere, and so you have a constant flux integrated over area. And then to simplify things, we just look at the mean opacity, and for the infrared, we're assuming this goes as temperature squared. Okay, and this is a reasonable approximation over some range of temperatures. Of course, we could consider more complicated things at some point if we wanted to. But the interesting thing is in this disk, because of radiative equilibrium, as we know, temperature has to increase with optical depth. Okay, and basically, if you know optical depth is very large, temperature goes as optical depth to the 1/4 power. But because of this temperature dependence in the opacity, that means the opacity increases with optical depth. So as we move deeper into the atmosphere, the opacity has to go up. Now, if you actually want to think about what that means for hydrostatic equilibrium, you can consider the case of constant gravity and specifically focus on the case where radiation pressure dominates so we can ignore the gas pressure gradient. And now, basically, hydrostatic equilibrium is just a balance between the radiation force, which is the gradient and the radiation pressure, and gravity. F is basically constant, a 1D problem. G is constant or increasing with height. But kappa is not constant. And it's basically very hard to set up a problem where kappa or varies in just the right way to balance G, because G generally increases upward, kappa generally increases downward. And so there's no hydrostatic equilibrium when radiation pressure dominates. So this is what Mark and Todd got from a simple 1D analysis. And so they wanted to look at numerical simulations of this. So they set up a fairly simple simulation problem. So again, a constant flux at the base of the domain that points upward, a constant gravity that points downward, two dimensions. The initial condition is isothermal. All the density is down here at the bottom. There's a sinusoidal perturbation at the to the density to sort of seed a Rayleigh-Taylor instability. The temperature they assume is 80 Kelvin. That's a bit high for a lot of Eulergs, but in practice, that precise value of the temperature scales out. What's really important are the Eddington ratio, the ratio of radiation force or radiation acceleration to gravitational acceleration in the initial condition, or if you like to think of it, at the photosphere. And so they consider values of 1/4 and 1/2, and the initial optical depth, or equivalently, the optical depth measured using the opacity at the photosphere. Okay, and so as I said, this is initially isothermal, but it's optically thick, so the temperature can't stay constant. Temperature has to heat up at the base of this atmosphere. That's going to cause the opacity to go up, and that's going to cause this ratio to go up. You'll become super Eddington, and you'll launch the whole shell upward. Okay, I'll just show you the movies from their simulations. They did consider an optical depth of 3, Eddington ratio of 1/2, optical depth of 10, Eddington ratio of 1/4, optical depth of 10, Eddington ratio of 1/2. And this is showing the log of the density. Okay, this moves pretty fast. So you have a shell that goes up. This Rayleigh-Taylor instability is an instability that occurs whenever you have a light fluid pressing on a heavier fluid. So in this case, the radiation basically plays the role of the light fluid, and the gas is basically the dense fluid. You saw that, I'll run it again. You saw this structure develop. You see these high-density plumes coming off after the Rayleigh-Taylor instability develops. You see these low-density channels open up. Most of the flux escapes along these low-density channels. And even though it's initially super Eddington, because the flux is escaping through the low-density channels, most of the radiation escapes. The volume average Eddington ratio drops below unity, and then everything falls back to the bottom. Okay? And so this was their argument, basically, of why, one of their arguments for why they thought radiation feedback might not work. Now, that was done using the Orion code, using flux-limit diffusion. I think you've had every reason to think that flux-limit diffusion might work well for that problem, but we had a code that for doing DET, so we decided to try to reproduce these results. And so in our Athena code, we also have our own implementation of flux-limit diffusion. So we basically just reran the same problem. Here I'll show you a simulation where we assumed an initial Eddington ratio of 1/2 and an initial optical depth of 1/2, or sorry, optical depth of 3. And so the only difference between what Mark and Todd did is we added random perturbations in addition to our sinusoidal perturbations. And that was necessary to get the Rayleigh-Taylor instability going really quickly in the VET calculations. Okay, and so I'll just run the simulation. And you can see the comparison. This is actually running for the same time as Mark's, roughly the same time as Mark's simulations, but it goes a lot slower. So again, you see a super Eddington shell being launched upward. Again, you see the Rayleigh-Taylor instability develop. Matter starts to fall back. In the flux-limit diffusion case, it falls back and hits the bottom of the domain and just kind of oscillates there. In the VET case, a lot of the density falls back. Some of it sort of falls back and doesn't really make it down. It gets kind of peeled off and re-accelerated. Some of it does get all the way to the bottom where we have reflecting boundary conditions, but then it gets accelerated back up. And basically, as we keep running it, eventually, you know, the mean velocity is above zero here, pointing upward. And eventually, we have to stop it when we get to the end of the top of the simulation domain because we have, we assume no incoming intensity up here, and that's no longer valid when a few optical depths of material has moved to the top of the domain. Okay, so why does that look so different? Well, I could have lots of slides explaining this, but I'll just focus on this one slide. If we have more questions, I'll try to answer it better. But this is a comparison of, on the top, two density distributions, one for the VET simulation, one for the flux-limit diffusion simulation. And so this is showing the log of the density. And then on the bottom here, I have the ratio of the vertical radiation flux to the radiation energy density. So this is just a small patch of the simulations for one specific time. And you can see where here, where things are very optically thick, very dense, you're optically thick, and this ratio is very small, where you're very optically thick in both simulations. And this is just the diffusion limit. When you're very optically thick, the flux is low. But when you get to regions that are not as optically thick, you can see if you look at the VET, it's fairly diffuse. The ratio varies, but it doesn't vary by that much, at least compared to the flux-limit diffusion calculations, where the ratio varies a lot more. And so what's happening is, as you cross some of these structures, which are not that optically thick, the optical depths across these structures are only a couple. The densities, though, varying quite a bit. It's varying by a large amount. And so this affects the flux limiter in a fairly specific way. And so you get fairly strong variations in the ratio of this vertical flux to the energy density, are at least stronger than the VET. And so what happens is, in both cases where you have low densities, you get increases, enhancements in the radiation flux in both simulations. But it's a much strong, it's a notably stronger effect in the flux-limited diffusion case because the radiation field is sort of less diffuse in some respects. Okay, but it's not that different. We're talking about order or sort of unity differences in the sort of angular distribution of the radiation field. And so if you actually compare these two simulations, if you actually just look at the volume average radiation force to the volume average gravitational force, VET is in black here and the FLD is in red, they don't look that different. But what you can notice is that the FLD tends to lie below a ratio of 1, where the VET tends to occupy space above this line. So the difference basically between this calculation is that it's slightly sub-Eddington for most of the run, whereas this calculation is slightly super-Eddington for most of the run. And here the dash curve just represents where I stopped. It's the end of the movie, and I stopped and reran this in basically a larger box with lower resolution. But you can see it continues to be above the Eddington limit in this case. Okay? So you can see what happens, though, is because it's one is above Eddington and one is below Eddington, you're getting different accelerations. And the integrated effect of those accelerations has a pretty big impact on both the velocity distribution and the vertical distribution of the gas. And so on top here, I have the mass-weighted vertical velocity, mean velocity, and the mass-weighted velocity dispersion. Black, again, is VET. Red is flux limit diffusion. And you don't see a huge difference in the velocity dispersion here. The maximum sort of Mach number here we get is about 15, which only corresponds to 8 kilometers per second, which is at least an order of magnitude too low to explain most Eulers. But I think the more important thing is if you actually look at it, in the FLD, you basically go to zero for your mean velocity. So things aren't getting accelerated upward. But the mean velocity in our VET calculation continues to increase. So basically, in this simple setup, the gas is completely unbound. I think we can say that pretty safely for this particular simulation. And so in a real simulation, or in a real disk, it is a real simulation. But in a real disk, the gravity is going to increase or vary with height. And if you continue to accelerate things upward, eventually, because of the variations in gravity, you're going to turn this vertical momentum into diffuse or turbulent momentum. And I think that understanding what the actual velocity dispersion that comes out of these sort of setups requires us to go to a slightly more sophisticated simulation setup. Okay. We've talked a lot about implications for momentum feedback. I'll just say a few things about this real quick. The Rayleigh-Taylor, I think the fair thing to say is it may or may not significantly inhibit momentum ejection. It kind of depends on what application you're interested in and what system. And I think, to be honest, we just haven't done a sophisticated enough calculation to give you a definitive answer about this yet. But roughly speaking, we can say, and this is more or less consistent with what Mark and Todd found in certain respects, is that the momentum injection, and just looking at the infrared here, is basically proportional L over C. And what matters if you want to compute this optical depth for this or this trapping factor is the flux-weighted optical depth. You have to integrate the optical depth, but weighting by the flux, because it's the flux that goes into computing the luminosity. And if you actually ask, well, what is the flux-weighted optical depth? Well, because you're basically going to this Eddington ratio near unity, the relevant opacity that comes in here is basically just the whatever opacity you need to get Eddington, given this flux and given this gravity, gravitational acceleration. Again, in this simple setup where we have constant flux and constant gravity. For this particular simulation, we get a flux-weighted optical depth of 6, so the trapping factor is around 6. And in terms of an efficiency, if you look at the ratio of the flux-weighted optical depth to the sort of total optical volume weight, average optical depth, the efficiency factor is actually reasonably high. It's about 0.7 for this particular run, although this depends on the optical depth and Eddington ratio at the start of the simulation. Just a really quick, highly speculative slide on outflows. So this is just taking one snapshot at one particular time from our simulation, looking at the mass fraction as a function of the vertical velocity. This is just in code units. But the main thing to point out is, so if you look at the velocity dispersion in these units, it's about 13 for this particular snapshot. And the mean velocity is, I think, about 15. But you have this tail going on to very high velocities. And so this is basically in those low-density regions, you're getting strongly accelerated gas to high velocities. And so, there's no reason to think that this scales up to a more realistic simulation. But if something like this holds, you can imagine a scenario where you're basically in hydrostatic balance with turbulent velocities, 100 kilometers per second, but you have a tail of velocity going up to 400 kilometers per second or more, which constitutes about 2 to 3% of the gas. So in principle, you could at least start launching outflows with something like this mechanism. And then finally, this is my last slide real quickly, just showing what happens when, I only showed you one case, but showing you what happens when we vary the optical depth. So this is the initial optical depth in the simulation, but you can also think of it as sort of the photospheric optical depth. Again, because the opacity decreases downward, the optical depth sort of is a function of where you evaluate as a function of height. And again, assuming in each case an initial Eddington ratio of 1/2. These are all VET simulations. The middle one is the one I already showed you. So as we increase the optical depth, you get actually a greater boost and a stronger acceleration. In this case, not very much material falls back. It starts falling back, but then because the opacity is getting even deeper, you know, larger as you get deeper in the atmosphere because the optical depth is higher, you get an even larger acceleration. And so you basically have very little material that falls back. Almost everything gets blasted up to the top of the domain. Again, we stop it. You can see for tau equals 1, we never actually get very much super Eddington. Because we had an initial Eddington ratio of 1/2. The increase in the opacity as you go down never really gets this to be significantly above Eddington, and everything sort of falls back. So it is true, I think, that if you want to have feedback mechanisms like this in Eulers or other regions, you really need the optical depths to be significantly bigger than unity, or at least a little bit bigger than unity, even in this simple setup. And the only caveat I would say about that is, you know, we don't really, you know how other sources of feedback are going to affect these simulations. If we put turbulence in from other sources like winds or cosmic rays or whatever, it could potentially change this conclusion. Okay? And so I'll just summarize. So if I didn't convince you, VET is better than FLD, and you should be using it if you can in the future. We do confirm, I think, the most important result in Mark and Todd's paper, and that is the Rayleigh-Taylor instability is inhibiting momentum feedback. I think it's just that, you know, it's in our calculations, it's not inhibiting it to the same degree because the gas is super Eddington, and so it does actually become unbound in our simulations, at least. And, you know, a small fraction of the gas is accelerated to very high velocities. At least this is something to think about when you're thinking about launching of outflows, because it's only a small fraction of the gas that's actually being accelerated out of these galaxies. Again, the results depend on optical depth. And if I didn't make it clear, I think this is not the last simulation I want to do. There's more realistic pieces of physics we can include. I figure we can milk this for at least 2 or 3 more papers. And I'll stop there.
Hi, Shane. Can you go back to one of your first slides where you showed P dot is 1 plus eta tau IR times L over C in our cosmological gas simulations?
Yeah. This is, you know, dispute this.
Yeah, and I guess you had a version with eta before.
Yeah, oh, sorry. Yeah.
So am I understanding correctly that what you have shown is that eta in this equation is about 0.6, 0.7, but that for tau IR much greater than 1, then it is the case that p dot scales linearly with tau IR?
Well, so for this particular, I showed one case. Now, it doesn't scale linearly. So I actually don't think it. Okay. That's a bit misleading, so I apologize for that. Well, what I said was that if you have if you want to compute the trapping factor, you multiply the surface density by this value of the opacity that gives you the Eddington limit. So as you increase the, if you actually think about how that, well, I could go through the math offline, but in practice, as you increase the optical depth, it's probably the case that the efficiency goes down. So I showed that simulation with the optical depth of 10 run. That efficiency factor is actually a little bit lower, but only by about a factor of 2. So instead of 0.7, it's more like 0.35 or 0.4. But if you tried to extrapolate this to very high densities and very low Eddington factors, I think you might run into trouble. But I could go into more detail.
But it does look like you're getting very
significant. Oh yeah, I think for physically interesting values of the optical depth and Eddington ratio, this efficiency factor is not that low, I would claim.
But did you just say that when you increase tau by a factor of 2, you decrease eta by a factor of 2?
A little less than 2. This is for, I should have just put the math in the slide. Basically, I said the opacity, here's the easy way to think of it. The relevant opacity is the opacity that gives you the Eddington ratio. So for all the simulations I showed, that initial Eddington ratio was 1/2. So that means that the characteristic opacity for these calculations is 2. And so 2 times the photospheric. So I for the simulation with optical depth of 3, I said that the flux-weighted optical depth was 6. So that's 2 times 6. Comes from that. For the optical depth of 10, it's 2 times 10, so it's 20. And so for the simulation with photospheric optical depth of 10, the trapping factor is 20 in the simulation. And if you integrate it and you volume average the opacity, because the total optical depth would be more like 50-something. Okay. Does that make sense? So in that sense, the efficiency did go down by a factor of 2, but the trapping factor went up by a lot. It's just that the volume averaged opacity went up by a lot more. Well, yeah. I mean, if you read the paper, it's fairly clear about how this works out. But I would not say the efficiency factor is constant. And it does drop as the opacity goes up.
I wonder whether the restriction to 2D is not a significant restriction of these simulations. The Rayleigh-Taylor instability is rather important here in the nonlinear regime. Have you tried any simulations in 3D?
I have not for this particular problem. We did an earlier paper on the Rayleigh-Taylor instability. I'm not sure exactly what you're worried about. I mean, we did a bunch of simulations with just scattering opacity. And so in the simulations with just scattering opacity, we looked at the growth rates of the Rayleigh-Taylor instability in both 2 and 3 dimensions and various nonlinear quantities. And I'll just show you, you're not going to really learn anything from this simulation, but I just like showing it. So this is showing the surface where the high density was on top, the low density was on bottom, and it was supported against radiation, or against gravity by radiation pressure. And you can see how the Rayleigh-Taylor instability develops and how this structure. If you actually look at the detailed structure on small scales, it actually looks a little different from the 2D problem. But if you actually, if you do sort of global, try to measure global properties of this flow, like how quickly the high-density material drops into the low-density material, how quickly the low-density material spreads into the high-density material, it doesn't look that different from 2D. Now, your argument is, well, the angular distribution might be a little bit different. And yeah, so. Yeah, so. Yeah, as you go in more and more into the nonlinear regime. So I think I would say, based on the simulations we've done so far, I don't think they're going to change things by, that much. But I'm talking about an order unity change in the angular distribution changing the result. So I can't claim that 3D is not going to be different, but I don't see why 3D would make the escape of photons more efficient. If anything, I would think it would be less efficient in 3D.
So Shane, you said one of your goals here was understanding how the neutral gas was launched in this wind. So one comment and then a question. I think one thing we've learned about these Eulergs is that there's a continuous flow of gas into the central region. Mm-hmm. So it may change things a bit too to consider that in this launching, that there's new neutral or molecular gas coming in mm-hmm. all the time as the system evolves. And then my question is, if I understood you correctly, you said the turbulent velocities are increasing, perhaps up to 100 kilometers per second or more as this gas goes up.
Well, we never see that in our simulations. But our boxes, I didn't say this, but our boxes okay. are way too small. This is the initial condition, is the initial box from top to bottom is less than a parsec. So we have to run these things in much larger boxes, I think, to get realistic velocity dispersions.
But you mentioned the number of 100, that was what you thought it would get up to? Or
oh, no, no, I said that was what I was talking about outflows. I said the velocity dispersion we actually see is more like 10 kilometers per second. And I was wildly speculating that my point there was simply that you have high velocity tails to the distribution. So that if the velocity dispersion does get up to around 100 kilometers per second, you might expect gas to be accelerated to even higher velocities than that. So factors of 3 or 4 higher. That was basically just that a small fraction of the mass gets accelerated to much higher velocities than the mean velocity.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
Let's How sensitive are the simulations to the number of rays you pick to converge, hopefully converge, the Eddington closure factor?
Yeah, I think we're pretty well converged. So I didn't say this, but this is a very good question. So we use 80 rays to do our calculations. And so I did this, I compared two different calculations, and you can see this in the paper if you want to take a look. So I didn't actually change the number of rays to do a resolution study, but what I did, so for a lot of our calculations, we have rays, we distribute our rays uniformly in solid angle. And even though it's a 2D simulation, that means we have rays that go into the third dimension. So what I did was I tried the case. So if you actually look, the Eddington ratio, the FZZ, the extra dimension, if you say that Z, the ZZ component doesn't change that much from 1/3. So if you just fix your resolution in that Z direction just to be one ploidal band and concentrate all your angular resolution in the azimuthal direction, so it's along the 2D plane, you basically increase your effective resolution by a factor of 3 to 4. And in that case, you see a reduction in some of the ray effects that you see in the optically thin region, but in the optically thick region, the Eddington tensors look identical. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's... Yeah. Yeah, so basically it scales linearly with the number of rays for the most part. I mean, it's certainly the case that there's a question of how high the angular resolution needs to be. My suspicion is that we certainly could try increasing the number of angles when we go to 3D by not much more than 80 and see, we can do a resolution study and see how much our results depend on the angular distribution, just like you do a resolution study in spatial dimensions. I agree that the 3D calculations are going to be much more expensive. That's why we haven't done them yet. I think it's a hard problem, and there's good reason to do that in the future. Just to give you a sense of how expensive these calculations are, it takes a week to do these. But one thing is I'm doing fairly high spatial resolution, even though it's 2D. I mean, this is typically 1,000 by 4,000. Maybe we can get by with lower spatial resolution, although we haven't really confirmed that yet. Yeah, so we've thought a lot about how to do adaptive angles. It's not trivial, although I'm not sure for this problem how well it'll help you because you have complicated structure. I think it's much better when you have sort of beam structure. We do turbulent MRI calculations with just 80 angles, and we do in 3D, and I think we actually do a pretty good job of getting the angular distribution of the radiation field. Just to show you a comparison I did, this is a 3D calculation. So this is through a 3D simulation of the magnetorotational instability. And this was just a 2D slice of that 3D calculation using 24 total angles in 3D and 168 angles. And this is the Monte Carlo. And the difference is almost completely dominated by the square root of n noise in the Monte Carlo. So, I mean, I don't think the number of angles is as bad as you might worry it might be.
Yeah, I mean, you already said many times that you need to have a more realistic setup, and that's fine. But I was wondering whether the aspect ratio of the box is not a fundamental parameter, because with this very elongated box, you prevent large scale mode to develop, and those probably will enhance the anisotropy and therefore favor the.
Yeah, I worried about this a little bit. I mean, it's certainly possible that it's a factor. I mean, one thing that I think is goes in the direction of thinking that this is okay for now, is that most of the structures, you know, if you actually looked at the movies carefully, a lot of the structure is fairly small scale compared to the horizontal size of the box. So we have, you know, many filaments across our box. And so at least in that sense, I'd be particularly worried if we had one big filament. But we generally have, you know, several filaments and sometimes only one or two plumes, though, but that's sort of a result of the initial condition. So I'm not sure it's a big factor, but it's certainly something worth thinking about.
So I just wanted to, yeah, so I was just going to make a comment as far as the, what values of tau are actually applicable to the real world?
So
this is something that, you know, that this is something that's just a definition. This follows simply, you know, the tau is simply defined, and I believe you used the same definition we did. And so I just thought I would say, you know, so tau of three, what does that correspond to? So tau of three, I mean, I'm just reading from the formula in our paper, that tau of three corresponds to, for a cloud with a normal IMF and 50% mass in gas, 50% in stars, tau of three corresponds to a surface density of 5 × 10⁴ solar masses per square parsec, or 10 grams per square centimeter. So just to get an idea of, you know, so what exactly how far you have to go to get to even tau of three is you have to be at something with a surface density of 5 × 10⁴ solar masses per square parsec.
Well, I mean, I think the question is, I mean, this is, I'm not an expert on this by any means. I you know, for me, it's enough to know that ARP220 gets in this regime for me to find it an interesting calculation to do. But I agree that if you want to understand how, you know, physically relevant this is, you need to look at the optical depth distributions of the ULIRGs. And there's probably people in here who are much better to assess whether such, you know, optical depths of three are reasonable or typical.
Right. But you can't calculate it by just plugging in a kappa of 5 cm² per gram. Right. It's important to point that out because a lot of the models where tau IR is used, it's computed by just taking surface density and multiplying by 5 cm² per gram. That's not the right tau to compare to what you're doing. It's
okay,
a very different tau.
Understood.
So just before we continue on with discussion, let's thank Shane again so he can sit down if he wants to.
I mean, it's just tau doesn't, kappa doesn't increase that much. It only, you know, since kappa is going as t squared, it goes as the square root of tau, and tau is small, so it's just not changing that much.
Well, no. I mean, I can tell you the difference. I mean, so with kappa of 5, tau of 3 corresponds to less than 1 gram per square centimeter as opposed to more than 10. Fair enough. I mean, kappa 5 may be too big to begin with. I just wanted to make the point that, you know, you have to use the right tau. To use this result, you have to use tau as it's defined in those simulations and as we defined it in our paper. And it's very important to distinguish that this is not the same tau IR that is normally referred to in models in the sort of numerical implementations. It's a very different tau.
So I'm going to jump in as chair just to interject that I'm not entirely sure how tau is defined in the models, but in ARP220 we have new ALMA data, and what we find from looking at the dust continuum and comparing the dust flux to dynamical masses is we have to use an optical depth per column of H that is at least 3 times different from what Planck gets in molecular gas, which is already a factor of 3 different from the atomic phase, in order to keep the gas mass below the dynamical mass. And so we have a surface density of, unfortunately it's in NH, 10 to the 25 H per centimeter squared. So I think it is in this really high, I can't do the conversion in my head standing up here. Yeah, so I mean, so it's absolutely true that this observationally, this optical depth has to change, and they see it with Planck, and we're seeing even more of a change in ARP220.
Yeah, it's very easy to what it should be. Just evaluate the optical depth using the surface temperature, whatever, so wherever the SED peaks, basically whatever frequency the SED peaks at.
65 Kelvin.
Yeah, so that's the temperature you should plug in to compute the optical depth. That's all it is. It's the optical depth evaluated using the opacity computed at the frequency corresponding to the peak of the emitted SED. That's all.
I mean, what we were actually finding was that the relevant opacity was slightly larger than the surface opacity, right? I mean, so we were, as I point out, for this specific problem, it's the opacity that gave you the Eddington ratio of unity, which was a slightly higher than the photospheric opacity, basically by a factor of 2, but that's only because we assumed an initial Eddington ratio of 1/2.
So to both clarify something in the galaxy scale simulations that are implementing the sort of subgrid model of this, but also to come to this point about where things self-regulate. So in the galaxy scale simulations, I wanted to clarify because I think there's been some misconceptions. So at least for our simulations, I've heard people quote that we just put a constant trapping factor of 50 or something. We're doing this very naively and simplistically. We are just doing the constant kappa times surface density, but the sort of time averaged effective trapping factor in the most optically thick simulations that we've simulated, which are super crazy merger like Euler systems, is a few. It's not what that misconception comes from is that if you just take this naive trapping factor, then you can, of course, get brief phases where you have extremely high surface densities and you get a transient peak where everything's collapsing and you get a naive optical depth computed that way of 100, and which we see in the real universe. If you just take that naive estimator of optical depth, there's gas densities that high in the centers of Eulergs around AGN, et cetera, at high redshifts. But even with no radiative transfer, what happens is an effect similar to what's just been described. If it's that high, then as soon as you couple, as soon as your star turns on and you start coupling the momentum there, it's super Eddington, and it just destroys that region instantly. It doesn't necessarily create a super wind, but it blows the stuff out locally until you get to sort of order the Eddington limit. And I think the exciting thing from both of these simulations is that, things get to the effective Eddington limit. Basically, it seems what I'm taking away is that if it is possible to get enough opacity, if the sort of maximum tau is sufficiently high that you could be super Eddington, then things will self-regulate at the stage where you're order Eddington, basically, which means you're doing work at a significant level. And clearly, whether or not it goes into a wind is very sensitive to whether you're just above or just below the Eddington limit. But in both cases, you're doing really significant work on that gas.
So I wanted to ask the chair to explain a bit more about the results from ARP-220. Because what I remember is that estimates of the column densities were typically sigma in grams per square centimeter of 10, which is your column of 10 to the 25. So that sounds consistent. And then this work from Jason's group that said that the optical depth at 100 microns was around 6 or something, is what I remember. The peak actually is a little shorter wavelength than 100 microns, is that right? There's a peak of the SED for like 50 or 60 microns or something. Yeah. So then the optical depth would be even higher there, because
it's not much higher.
Right, it's factor 2 or whatever. So Christine, was that consistent with what you were saying?
Well, what I'm just going to do is show you.
Real data,
that's right. I wasn't sure. I'm glad we have a discussion going up. So what we have here is...
Thank you. What we have here is an ALMA image of ARP-220 with a resolution of about 0.3 arcseconds, which is about 100 parsecs at this distance, and it's at a wavelength of 434 microns. And so we see the two peaks that were shown in Shane's talk as well. But the difference here is because we are at shorter wavelengths than previous millimeter observations, it appears that we are where the dust is starting to become optically
thick. And so we can get better handles on the dust temperature and the optical depth and the sizes of the sources. And so what we see is down here at the bottom, we have temperatures of between 60 and 80 Kelvin for the two nuclei, which actually agrees with the large global measurement from Rangwala et al. The radii of the two disks is between 60 and 100 parsecs. The one on the left is a bit bigger than the one on the right. And the gas column density is 10 to the 25. So we had to do the gas column density. You take the flux measurement. We started by assuming a value of tau, optical depth per column of hydrogen from Planck, appropriate for this wavelength. But if you do that, you get a mass of gas and dust that's a factor of 3 too large for the dynamical masses that have been published. And some really good dynamical masses come out of the IRAM data at lower or longer wavelengths. So what we had to do was take, and we were already using the kappa from molecular gas, the 2011 paper where they looked at torus. So not the diffuse thing, which is what the drain models are predicated on. And so we had to change that by a factor of 3 even further, just to bring the gas to dust mass below the dynamical mass. And there's no saying it couldn't be even lower. But the optical depth remains the same, because if you know, the tau is what you measure, it's how you get it to mass. As an observer, I have to talk to Mark and understand how kappa varies with temperature, because I don't understand that, and I'm not going to if I'm standing up here and he's explaining it to me, so he can do it later. I can look at his paper.
So what you're saying, though, is that the opacity per gram is higher. You have to use a high opacity per gram.
I think it goes in that sense, yes.
Presumably what you're saying, though, is you have a lot of big dust grains. This must be what you're saying.
Presumably. I mean, but it is very high. It's high volume density as well. And so the combination of sort of high volume density and high temperature is not something that people have modeled or that's seen in, say, local star-forming clouds. I mean, when the density in a low-mass core gets high, the opacity does get higher, but not as high as what we see.
The only thing that's a little bit funny about this is, I mean, you know, you do see grain growth in GMCs in the Milky Way, so that's not surprising, but the velocities, we think, are 100 kilometers a second. You might think that the grains would be
being shattered or something.
Right?
Yeah, no, the lines are very broad, but the CO data, which I don't have with me to show, and that's going in a separate paper that Nassim Rangwala is working on, is the CO lines are wide, but the CO emission is also more extended. And so what we're seeing is a sort of compact, very high column density region that may be so high column density that we can't actually measure the CO lines in there because the dust is obscuring the CO lines. And so really knowing what the velocity dispersions are in those disks is kind of hard to say, I think.
They're not going down.
Well, I don't know. If they're very thin disks, maybe. Sure.
What do we know about AGN?
There's definitely some evidence for an AGN. I mean, no. You want to answer that? You know,
yeah, here. There's definitely a very. Could I use this opportunity to ask another question too? So there's definitely a buried AGN in at least one of the nuclei, and probably both. And there are multiple lines of evidence for that. But in terms of heating this gas, it's not bolometrically important. Okay, so it's there. We see the evidence for it, but it's not responsible for this emission. So since we're still on the topic, though, I had a question. The previous the simulations we saw, I think your geometry was that you had basically a planar distribution of stars at the, you know, at the midplane, at the bottom, right? But, you know, in reality, the stars are going to be distributed. They're not going to be in the midplane. And that means that in one direction, the radiation has an easier opportunity to escape. And also, the radiation pressure is going to be more isotropic. And it seems like that would have implications for launching a wind. And since you're near the Eddington limit, I'm wondering if you could comment on that.
Well, yeah, I mean, we would love to put point sources distributed throughout the simulation domain. Technically, it's a little difficult to do that, where it's a little unclear exactly the best way to do that, but that's certainly something we want to do in the future. And also put in the time dependence of those sources, because you know this is a sort of finite lifetime for these things. And I think what's unclear to me is exactly whether this is a net benefit or negative for radiation feedback as a probable mechanism. I would think I would think that in the end it might not make too much of a difference how the sources are distributed. You'll have some cancellation of momentum in terms of driving turbulence, but I think what you said is right. For driving winds, it might make a lot more difference if we put the sources in actual clusters.
So, a question for you: what do you learn about the velocities from your CO measurements?
So we haven't finished analyzing them, but what we see as far as CO line profiles and so on and velocity fields looks quite similar to what's been seen in the CO 3-2 and CO 2-1 lines. We start to see more absorption features in the center, which I think is due to the effect of these dust disks. But no, I mean, this almost as broad line widths, which is a few hundred, several hundred kilometers per second. There seems to be some CO in absorption. So there's something colder running in front of these nuclei. There's also things that are sort of weak shoulders in some of the low CO lines that become brighter in CO 6 to 5. So there may be different excitation gas. But you see very nice velocity fields, as have been seen before. But for example, the nuclei are elongated. This extension is the major axis of rotation, so that it's rotating that way. And then actually this one is rotating the other way. The extension is because of the beam being oriented that way. So it's consistent, I would say, with what's been seen. You know, whether you can tell whether these disks are like tomb ray stable or unstable depends very critically on what the dispersion of the line is, and I'm worried that we're not actually getting the right value because of the effect of the dust.
I guess I just wanted to comment that ARP220 is, it's the prototype like TTARI, but it's really not typical of a ULERG. You know, it's really the most extreme case is of a brick wall. There might be only, I can think of, three or four other that might be similar to ARP220, but nearly all the other ULERGs have an estimated column density that are smaller than ARP220. So that also, I mean, I know that modeling ARP220 is a first challenge, but when it comes to actually understanding ULERGs, one will have to understand also that the column density of many ULERGs are smaller than what's in ARP220.
Can I ask then, so I mean, what do you think the optical depths are in those other ULERGs?
Just thinking in terms of column density, we're talking about certainly less than 10 to 24, because many of them, a few of them have evidence for AGN, as was mentioned, and direct light AGN. And so many cases, it's not compton thick. Of course, comparing X-ray with CO is a dangerous game, but overall, even the CO estimate are more like 10 to 24 or less for most ULERGs.
If that's true, then what would be driving these outflows for those estimates you just gave? That's a general question.
So I think people have made the point in some of the talks earlier, right? Some of those outflows are very high velocity and they look like they're associated with the AGN, so some of them are AGN. But there are plenty of ULERGs that have, you know, sodium outflows, which are definitely not associated with AGN. So there's more than one perpetrator, I would say. Although exactly what it is, you know, you say it's the AGN, well, what do you mean? There's a lot of possibilities. The jet is not driving that outflow. There's broad absorption line winds, which you see, Mark Herring 231 is a BAL. It could still be radiation pressure. I kind of don't think so, but it could be. It could be shocked, you know, if you've shocked the wind, and you can use cosmic rays to push stuff out. using an AGM. Any of those things in principle could work. But none of them are obviously working.